There's the American economy, of course. There's American politics. And then there's the American economy once politics gets done with it. And it is seldom pretty. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 8th of October. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. To apply a sporting metaphor to what happened in Washington this afternoon, this, one might say, is why they play the game. To a collective gasp of, wait, what? This afternoon, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy announced he is out of the race to become Speaker of the House. Couldn't get the votes, it seems. With John Boehner set to retire as Speaker at the end of the month, the economy is now squarely in the political crosshairs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on the line from Washington with more on this. Hey, Kimberly.
Hey, Kai.
So this is, one might say, incredibly bad economic timing, right? Let's look at the calendar here.
It's a pretty bad timeline coming up. I mean, they're supposed to renew highway funding before the end of the month. Then they are supposed to raise the debt limit by November the 5th. And then there needs to be another budget deal by December 11th. Because, of course, Congress only agreed to a short-term fix when we had this big, oh my goodness, there might be a shutdown situation last week.
All right, so let's talk about what they've been doing since then, because it's not like they're just standing around.
Oh, no, of course not. Congress? No way. They have gotten a couple of things done. They've passed some actually a fix for Obamacare that the president signed, as well as some updates to STEM education and a couple of little small things. Bigger items, the Senate has passed a new defense authorization bill, but Obama promises he's going to veto it because the administration wants the leverage of defense spending to negotiate overall budget spending.
This is another sort of layer in that broad wall of uncertainty that we've been talking about this program lately. You got the Fed and interest rates. You've got uncertainty here in Washington. This is just more of it, right?
Yeah, and that uncertainty actually costs money, because even when there isn't a government shutdown, and even when we don't necessarily hit that debt ceiling or surpass it, the government and the federal agencies actually have to prepare for it. So that means there are thousands of federal workers spending thousands of hours and our money getting ready for what they might have to do in case of a shutdown. Also, because these agencies and other organizations and contractors don't necessarily know what their budget is going to look like very far in advance, they are paying more for things that they might be able to get at better prices if they knew in the long term. So there is an ongoing discussion between the White House and congressional leadership on what a new budget deal might look like. They want it to last longer, maybe up to 2 years, but definitely through the 2016 campaign.
We should say here that Speaker Boehner, it's not like on the 30th of October, he's just going to up and go, right? He's going to stick around until the Republicans figure out what they're going to do, yeah?
Yeah, he says that he is definitely going to stay in his position until there is a new Speaker of the House. He was looking quite displeased with the announcement today, to put it mildly, and the House Republican caucus was definitely in shock. And I don't think it's too much of a jump to say that Boehner is not the happiest person on Capitol Hill today.
One more thing, and then I'll let you go. It is not inconceivable that it is a very conservative member of the Republican caucus that takes this job, and that might conceivably influence the way things go legislation-wise.
This is true, but that's going to be a challenge, because even though the Republican caucus gets to pick who they want for Speaker, it still has to go to a full House floor vote. Mm-hmm. And so there's already discussion of needing to bring in some Democratic support to push whichever candidate can get the most support over that line to actually be Speaker. But you're right, it could push the entire legislative agenda even more conservative. And as long as President Obama is in the White House, that could mean we see even less getting done.
Kimberly Adams at the Marketplace Bureau in Washington, D.C., an interesting day in the nation's capital. Kimberly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I don't know. Maybe traders figured Washington's going to figure it out, because they always do. Whatever, it is going to be the happy music when we get there. Details, numbers, you know the drill. It's going to be a couple of months until Congress takes up the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal the White House has been pushing, and negotiations over which finished up on Monday. President Obama, when we talked to him on Tuesday, acknowledged that the TPP puts him at odds with many members of his own party, one of whom is Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
It's a delight to be with you. Thank you so much.
The president told me the other day, and he has said in times past, that his view of trade and free trade in this economy, in this global economy, is that you can't build a moat around the United States if we want to succeed. Do you think he's talking about you when he says that?
I hope not. No, because no one is talking about building a moat around the United States. What we are talking about, and we have been almost for the last 2 years, is to review our trade agreements in light of the economic challenges that we face. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement really undermines wage growth. That's what we have to be mindful of the result of the trade agreement and loss of jobs and depression of wages.
How specifically does it do that, ma'am? What is your main concern with this agreement? Specifically now.
First of all, this trade agreement is modeled on the Korea Free Trade Agreement, which we did just 3 years ago. And Economic Policy Institute has calculated that has already cost the United States about 75,000 jobs in just these last 3 years. Our trade deficit has doubled with Korea. Trade deficit leads to job loss. Added to that is the issue of currency manipulation.
Well, let's talk about currency manipulation.
Oh, I'd love to.
All right. Well, maybe not love, but we're going to talk about it anyway.
Okay.
There is, as you know, a side agreement in this deal to handle the issue of currency manipulation. Congress and the president went back and forth during early stage negotiations. What exactly are you not satisfied with that stands in the agreement right now?
Anyone will tell you, and I could quote economists all over the place here, when a country devalues their currency, that means their goods are cheaper here. We lose jobs. Our products are more expensive and their products less, and that is what is directly related to a loss of jobs. And again, with this agreement, with the 30 chapters involved, by the way, which we've not been able to see the text of this.
Although you have seen them in the negotiating stage.
There were pieces of it that have been updated where we saw they were classified. So we saw them in a classified a setting. And quite frankly, I suspect if you talk to many, many members, most of them feel that their questions were not answered.
This agreement will come to Congress in the next several months, ma'am. I'm going to assume you're a no vote. What do you give the odds of this thing passing?
I believe that this, I think it will, when it is a public document and everyone sees it, including members of Congress, which we have not seen it in its entirety, I believe that on a bipartisan basis, both Democrats and Republicans are going to vote against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut. Ma'am, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Congressional Republicans aren't the only ones with a leadership problem right now. Sepp Blatter, the embattled head of FIFA, has been suspended for 90 days, as have two of his top deputies. It's not just Blatter who's in trouble, really. It's soccer as a global enterprise, because with charges of widespread corruption and a continuing criminal investigation, FIFA's probably going to have a tough time finding somebody to run things. Not only is Blatter on the outs, so are most of the other candidates within the organization who might be likely choices to fill the void. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Things are not looking good for FIFA. The entire top layer of the organization has been kicked out. Major sponsors, Coca-Cola, Visa, McDonald's, are demanding that something be done. It's what you would call
a crisis of epic proportions.
Mary Jo Jacoby is an expert in crisis management and a former assistant secretary at the Department of Commerce. She says FIFA is being accused of being slow to act amid charges of massive corruption. Jacoby says it's one thing if you have a problem with a player.
But without the sponsors, you don't have the money to fund the sport.
Jacoby says one option for FIFA would be to bring in someone from the outside with a reputation for integrity to take charge and provide reassurance for sponsors. There is another option.
In every organization, no matter how corrupt it is, there has to be someone who is not corrupted by it yet.
Sounds like we're talking about a needle in the haystack.
Patrick Risch is director of the Sports Business Program at Washington University in St. Louis. He says there's growing sentiment that an independent organization should step in. But he says if they really want the sport cleaned up, sponsors may have to take real action.
They know that being tied to soccer is a great vehicle for getting their product in front of millions and millions and millions of people.
But nothing says serious like pulling your ad dollars. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We don't sue the can't pays, we sue the won't pays.
Problem is figuring out who are the can'ts and who are the won'ts. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 138 points today, 0.8%, closed at 17,050. The NASDAQ added 19 points, about 0.4%, finished at 48.10. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.8%, ended at 2013. The big banks didn't move much on minutes from the Fed's September meeting, which showed continued inflation worries. Goldman Sachs on the low end was off 0.6%. Wells Fargo on the high end up 0.6%. Commodity prices have crumbled, we keep saying, but maybe things are bottoming out. I don't know. Tech Resources Limited, which mines all sorts of stuff, up 7%, 86% for the week. Freeport-McMoRan, another big miner, up 3.4% today, 26% for the week. Bond prices down, though. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Dropbox for Business. Dropbox for Business enables teams to work together on any file from anywhere while also giving IT the administrative features and security controls they need. Dropbox for Business, all yours. And by Avalara, tax automation for businesses of all sizes. Avalara's cloud-based technology is designed to simplify business tax by performing real-time tax calculations and enabling automatic return filing. Learn more at avalara.com. And by Palo Alto Networks, creators of Navigating the Digital Age, a guide to protecting your company, your customers, and your future. Made in partnership with the New York Stock Exchange. Available at paloaltonetworks.com/nextgenCEO.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The tech story of this day comes not out of Silicon Valley or the corridors of high finance in New York, but rather from Round Rock, Texas, and the headquarters of Dell. The now privately held Dell is still the world's third biggest maker of personal computers, and as of today, is the bidder in what would be the biggest dollar value tech deal ever. Dell has made an offer for the data storage company EMC. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is here with the details and the why it matters. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. I need you to run me through this, though, right? This whole enterprise computing solutions and storage and virtualization. Help me understand this.
Yeah, it's okay if you feel like it is, as one outlet described it, the boringest merger of all time.
but it's giant, right?
But it's giant. Yeah, it is partly interesting just because of the sheer size of the deal. If Dell bought all of EMC, EMC is valued at $50 billion. So it would be, it sounds like, certainly the biggest tech merger or tech leveraged buyout ever. It's also interesting because it's Dell. I mean, Dell is, you know, for a lot of us, the first computer we ever had. It's also gone dark. It took itself private in 2013. It's been quietly getting out of consumer electronics and focusing more on this kind of enterprise, providing services to businesses and this whole cloud computing thing. So it'd be a real turnaround for Dell. And I think a lot of us are weirdly rooting for that.
All right, explore this a little bit, because when Michael Dell took his company private, he piled on a ton of debt. This deal is expensive. What's he going to get out of it? How does this play out well for him?
He did. Yeah, we'll talk about the expensive part later. But, you know, if they pull it off, it's all about cloud computing. And cloud computing, again, sounds really boring, but it's where all the money is in the tech industry right now. And so here's how it's working. Right now, any company that provides these so-called cloud services, let's say it's Apple or it's Amazon, that just means they're storing information on computers that are connected to the internet. They're making sure the information is secure, and then they're serving it up on demand. So if you're Apple or you're Amazon, you can build a private cloud, and somebody like Dell or Microsoft or HP will sell you the computers and some of the software and services that handles all the actual data. But increasingly, more and more companies want to rent a cloud. So they want to keep all the computers and the management and the security stuff, keep that somewhere else. And so EMC and Dell both build servers. They build computers. But EMC does all this data security and software for managing the massive amounts of data. So if Dell combines with EMC, all of a sudden it can say, listen, we have a whole cloud service in a box. We can, and we can sell you the box too.
All right. So back to the dollars and cents of this thing. Michael Dell and the company are leveraged to the hilt. Now they're going to do more debt acquisition to buy this company?
Yeah. Where there is doubt about this deal, that's where it comes in, because Dell has over $11 billion in debt. CNBC reported today that they would need to borrow another $40 billion to make this deal happen.
Wow.
That's, you know, that's the debt load of a small country. So we'll see.
Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Debt, as we talk about every now and then on this program, is a business, a multi-billion dollar business. It can be bought and sold and traded, and when debt remains unpaid, it can be sued over. Paul Keel and his colleagues from the investigative reporting group ProPublica spent months sifting through court records involving debt collection and how lawsuits are often used unequally to recover some of those unpaid debts. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson helps tell the story.
The kind of lawsuits we're looking at are usually filed against people who have defaulted on debts for relatively small amounts, a few thousand dollars, sometimes less. But very little information exists about who is being sued and why. So, Paul, you focused on court cases in St. Louis, Newark, and Chicago. What did you find?
Right. We pulled court records from each city and we compared them with census data. And if you plot these cases on a map, we found they were overwhelmingly in mostly black neighborhoods. In fact, even when you control for income, residents of mostly black neighborhoods were twice as likely to be hit with a court judgment as residents of mostly white ones.
Meaning, even when people make similar amounts of money, people in black neighborhoods are still being sued more often.
Exactly. So I started knocking on doors in one of these neighborhoods in St. Louis.
You want to see one of my paycheck stubs?
Corey Winfield let me into the home she shares with her four kids.
I can show you. I'm going to show you the difference.
And she digs out a pay stub and shows me her take-home pay.
This is what a regular paycheck looks like without garnishment. The net is at the bottom.
She makes just under $17 an hour.
So that's good. And then Friday, this is what I got.
Since 2012, a company called Midwest Acceptance has been garnishing her paycheck.
Usually like anywhere between 260 and 290, with the 25% being taken out.
The garnishment started at a quarter of her take-home pay, but because she has kids, she can get it down to 10%. This all started back in 2009. Corey needed a new car to get to work to haul her kids to school. She'd always paid cash for cars before, but this time she didn't have enough.
I asked my grandma if she could help me out. And grandma couldn't help out. She usually always could help out, but she couldn't help out with this situation.
So she found a local dealership, picked out a 2002 Dodge Caravan, and they arranged a loan with Midwest for a bit over $8,000. The annual interest rate was almost 30%. Then her financial situation took a turn around the same time that she was separating from her husband.
So a lot of bills did just get left unpaid. I just wasn't on it like the way I should have been.
So one night, around 11 o'clock, a man knocks at the door.
He was asking, you know, if it's this my vehicle, blah, 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 and I was like, shoot.
Midwest repossessed the van and sold it. They added on some fees for the sale and then sued Corey for the remaining balance, $4,900. By taking her to court, Midwest was able to get a judgment against her that allows them to garnish her wages. Because interest is still running on the debt, Corey will likely pay at least $11,000 in garnishments by the time she's done.
Mm-hmm. That's well more than what the damn vehicle costs, not to mention what it's actually worth.
If she keeps going at this pace, she won't pay off the loan until sometime in 2017. And to give you a sense of how common these types of debt collection lawsuits are, Corey's mom has also been sued over her debt. So was the woman who moved into Corey's old house after she left. That house was in Jennings, where the mayor and five of the eight sitting city council members have also been sued. In fact, in Jennings, there were more than 20 judgments for every 100 residents over a five-year period. And we found that court cases from the rest of St. Louis, Chicago, and Newark showed similar racial imbalances. So Tracy and I tried to understand why this was happening.
Right, because what's happening here is fully legal. The credit system is based on people repaying their debts. If they don't, creditors have the right to sue.
We don't sue the can't pays, we sue the won't pays.
Jan Steger is executive director of DBA International, a trade group for debt buyers. These are companies who buy defaulted debt for pennies on the dollar and then try and collect on it. Debt buyers bring a lot of these types of cases.
When we told Steger how people in black neighborhoods were more likely to be sued than white residents, she said race was never a factor when deciding who to sue.
It's not that we're not concerned about it, but, I mean, the fact is that these are all just objective business decisions being made on an account.
Midwest declined to do an interview for this story. Same for other companies that file large numbers of these suits. But many sent statements saying something similar. They treat everyone the same.
So what then might account for the racial disparity in this data? We put that question to William Darity, a public policy professor at Duke University.
There has to be something about the situation that faces black borrowers that makes them more vulnerable to situations in which they're not going to be able to make payment.
His theory?
The huge differential in wealth between black and white households.
Take a black family and a white family with similar incomes. The white family will typically have a lot more wealth, maybe from equity in their house, savings, or investments.
There's this emergency backstop.
Darity says you can trace the wealth gap's roots all the way back to slavery and up through discriminatory public policies stretching into the 60s and 70s. One group builds wealth to pass on to their children, the other less so. Compound that over time, and it's getting worse.
Before the Great Recession takes place, circa 2007, 2006, blacks probably had about $1 in wealth for every $9 or $10 or so that whites held. Now it's $1 for every $12 to $13.
A smaller cushion to fall back on means that if there's some sort of financial emergency, then they're less likely to be able to recover. And at the community level, that means family and friends might not be able to help either.
And for certain types of debt, there may be another factor here, starting with the loan's origination. Sarah Wolf is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
So we see across all kinds of products, subprime auto lending, subprime mortgages, payday lending, car title lending, that blacks and Hispanics are more likely than white borrowers to receive loans that have sort of problematic features.
Will says, even when you factor in that black borrowers tend to have lower credit scores than white borrowers,
the loan costs more, the interest rate costs more, and over the life of the loan, the borrower will pay more,
which raises the risk of default.
But in the end, why these racial disparities exist is perhaps less important than the simple fact that they're there in the data. Peter Holland, a lawyer who defends against these cases, says if U.S. courts are being used in a way that creates this racially unequal outcome, that's a problem. He says people are entitled to due process.
Equal treatment under law. One red flag for due process is when you see a racially disparate impact.
He says it's up to lawmakers to investigate. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
And I'm Paul Keel for ProPublica.
You can read the full story of ProPublica's investigation and see pictures of Corey Winfield and her neighborhood in St. Louis at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the caveat that anybody can sue anybody for anything. All of that said, there was a lawsuit filed here in California today that is, I think, a piece of work is the phrase you're looking for. Bill Gross, who you might have heard referred to in the financial press as the Bond King because he started and for many years ran the world's biggest bond fund at PIMCO here in Southern California. He left the company last year under unpleasant circumstances. He sued PIMCO today for, among other things, breach of contract. And here, to finally get to the point, is the opening line of his lawsuit, quote, driven by a lust for power, greed, and a desire to improve their own financial position and reputation at the expense of investors and decency, a cabal of PIMCO managing editors plotted to drive founder Bill Gross out, end of quote. It goes on for 100 pages like that. Bill, tell us how you really feel, would you? Bill Gross, by the way, he is looking for, quote, not less than $200 million in damages, end quote. All right, here we're gone. The Dow Industrials up 138 points. That is up 138 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ added 19 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.8% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.